this morning is Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District versus American International Specialty Lines et al. Mr. Rattan?
May it please the Court, my name is Mark Rattan. I represent American International Specialty Lines Insurance Company, which we call AISLIC. In my 15 minutes that I have for my initial argument today, I want to emphasize three errors of law that we contend that the trial court made in reforming an insurance policy to include an amorphous and ill-described parcel of land in Milwaukee called Lincoln Creek, or that was often referred to as Lincoln Creek. The three major issues that I want to highlight today are the trial court virtually ignored overwhelming negligence on the part of Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, which I'll call MMSD, and its agent Sedgwick. The second error of law is the trial court ignored the doctrine of dual agency and well-established Wisconsin law, providing that a broker can be an agent of both the insured and the insurer. Finally, the trial court, we submit, committed an error of law in transposing the duty of an insurer and an insured when it comes to investigating and getting incomplete information on an insurance application. Wisconsin law, and I believe the law of virtually every other state, places that duty squarely on the insured when the insured is told more information is necessary to get your policy issued. The duty is not on the insurer to go find that, or the insurer or the broker to go find that information out. So I'll start with MMSD's and Sedgwick's negligence.
Could I actually ask you to start at the second one? Because sure. It seems to me that the pivotal question in this case is the proper characterization of Crump. So I guess there are three possibilities. Crump is MMSD's agent, functionally, or sub-agent working for Sedgwick as an agent. Possibility number two, which you touched on, is some form of dual agency. And possibility number three, which is what the district court adopted, is that Crump is an agent for AISLIC, is really an insurer agent. And so think that dual agency would be enough to get you off the hook, and I wonder if you could maybe start with that.
Well, I'd be happy to. Yes, I believe dual agency does get us off the hook, and not to retreat from our position that Crump was not our agent, but even if they were, if you look at the record, AISLIC's underwriter, Matt Henry, unequivocally told Crump and Tim Turner and Colleen Ryan, both of whom were at Crump, I'm not insuring this property. And he's got faxes. You know, the record is replete with that. So then you ask the question, okay, on whose behalf was Crump working? Well, all you have to do is look at the fundamental theme of MMSD's case, is that they relied on their brokers, including Crump, to get them the insurance that they wanted for this Lincoln Creek parcel. If they're relying on them, then how can Crump not be MMSD's agent? And at one point, MMSD tried to file a direct action against Crump, alleging that Crump was their agent and that Crump dropped the ball. How can Crump not be their agent?
Well, that was rejected on timeliness grounds, as I recall. Is that right?
Correct. But the fact that they tried to do it, and had they done it timely, it would be in the case today, mm-hmm. illustrates that Crump, at the very least, was MMSD's agent.
So you think it's unreasonable as a matter of law if, for example, MMSD had said we were relying on AISLIC just to cut all the agents out? You would never rely on the other side?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. So why would there not have been at least apparent authority on Crump's part to speak for AISLIC?
Because if you look at the law of agency in Wisconsin and the this court's decision in Mazzullo, which I know was applying Illinois law, but I believe was completely consistent with Wisconsin concepts of broker agency, you look at the fact that Crump was just, vis-a-vis AISLIC, it was just doing ministerial duties. It was taking a binder that Aislik issued, cutting and pasting it onto Crump's letterhead, which is typical in the industry, and forwarding that to MMSD.
But with the important addition of Lincoln Creek, right?
Well,
they threw that in there.
But the fact that they didn't have authority to add Lincoln Creek illustrates that they were not, that they had no apparent authority to do that. And they had no authority whatsoever. And in fact, 5 minutes after Mr. Henry at Aislik, the underwriter, gets a fax from Crump saying, oh, by the way, we told Sedgwick that Lincoln Creek is insured, he sends a no-nonsense, angry fax back to him, says, no, it isn't, and in so many words says, you don't have this authority.
So I have no problem imagining that that's a very conclusive negation of actual authority, because Mr. Henry tells him, you know, you had no authority to do this. But I mean, this seems so complicated to me, and I know from Mizzullo and the other cases, it's just the way the industry has done that, but several steps down the chain is MMSD. How are they supposed to know that Crump had no authority to put Lincoln Creek in that binder?
They didn't even know who Crump was. So that would be one point. They dealt exclusively with Sedgwick. In addition, I don't believe apparent authority can be determined by the unilateral declarations of the agent. Sedgwick would have had reason for there to be apparent authority. Sedgwick would have had to have reason to believe that Crump had this authority, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that Sedgwick believed that Crump had that authority. But see, again, we're getting into whether Crump was Aislik's agent. Mm-hmm. And in fact, any substantive work, any non-ministerial work that Crump did was to negotiate on behalf of Sedgwick and MMSD to get the best deal from Aislik that they could. And that's illustrated not only by Mr. Turner's testimony that he believed he was working for Sedgwick and MMSD, trying to get them the best deal, but the fact that he repeatedly, on their behalf, kept running back to Mr. Henry, we want coverage for Lincoln Creek, and being told no. So any substantive negotiation or work he did was on behalf of MMSD and Sedgwick. Anything he did for Aislik was strictly passing binders back and forth, collecting premium, sending the policy out to Sedgwick. That's all ministerial.
How is an individual like Mr. Crump financially rewarded? Where does he draw his revenue in a transaction such as this?
Commission.
From whom?
Aislik. I mean, I believe the way it works, and I'm not sure there's a whole lot in the record on this because it wasn't dwelled on at the trial or in discovery, but Sedgwick and Crump each get a commission. I don't even know how much it was because I don't even think there's anything in the record about that.
Does that speak in any way? Is that any indicia of agency?
No, I don't believe so because, again, you're looking at what were they really doing. And if they're just doing ministerial acts and they really have no authority to do anything other than that, who pays the commission is irrelevant. I think it comes out of the premium. And again, there's very little, if anything, on the record in this case on that.
Yeah, no, I didn't discover any.
I'm just telling my understanding about how it happened, but I'm not sure there's anything in the record.
Now, you're relying on this Wisconsin statute, right, that draws a distinction between people who are insurance brokers and insurance agents?
Right. I think the record shows that
628.02. Yeah.
That vis-a-vis Aislik, Crump was simply an intermediary. And as such, and the case law that we cited, Appleton, Gilbert, Reisenmeister, they all stand for the proposition that a broker can be a dual agent. And again, without retreating from our position that Crump was not Aislik's agent, the record is overwhelming that they were certainly MMSD's agent. And once they become MMSD's agent, then every fax from Mr. Henry to Mr. Crump and all the information in there, including the fact where he says, yes, I have an objection, Lincoln Creek is not an insured property, that's all imputed to MMSD, all of which the trial court ignored and made no findings about.
Well, did the trial court make a finding with regard to Mr. Crump? I mean, didn't he and I'm quoting from the court, the undisputed fact demonstrate that Crump's actions were not limited to, quote, collecting premiums or forming other ministerial acts. I mean, doesn't the district court make a finding? He goes on to suggest that certain acts were ministerial, but then says, however, other actions, most notably the issuance of the insurance binder, he finds that issuance not to be ministerial. And he says under the undisputed facts, the court finds that he was an insurance agent, as that term is defined. Now, so that's the error of law, you say, or is that a fact error?
I believe it's an error of law in the sense that when a court applies facts to law, that's a legal issue, and if it's wrong, it's an error of law that's a de novo review. But I don't think there was anything in the record that sustained that finding. Particularly when he issues an unauthorized binder and gets cut off at the knees for it by the underwriter, who reprimands him in no uncertain terms and says, this is misleading. Yes, I have an objection. And I think Mr. Henry's testimony at trial was he walked by the fax machine, saw the fax, and was livid, and hand wrote on there, Lincoln Creek is not an insured property, and sent him the same fax back within 5 minutes of receipt.
Now, I thought I remembered at some point some discussion that the binder itself, in a sense, drops out of the case. I mean, it's only good for a rather short period of time, which would be typical. And when the actual policy comes through, there's no ambiguity that the Lincoln Creek property is not one of the scheduled properties.
Right. Policy supersedes the binder. That law is universal just about everywhere, including Wisconsin.
And no one relied on the binder during the period of time it was in effect?
Well, no, because MMSD, I don't think, ever even saw it. There's no justifiable reliance on the part of Sedgwick because they get two faxes from Mr. Turner conveying Mr. Henry, the underwriter's, concern, saying this property will not be insured unless we get a site address. And by the way,
and Mr. Turner is the agent who's working for Crump, right?
Right. He's a Crump broker.
Okay.
And he unequivocally tells Sedgwick we at the least have to have a site address. And I should hasten to add that a site address, there's nothing in the record to indicate that that policy would have been issued or that property would have been insured even with a site address. That's just the start of the underwriting process. The four properties that were insured were all sewage treatment plants, and Mr. Henry testified in so many words, that's a no-brainer. They're low risk. I like insuring sewage treatment plants. But this Lincoln Creek, if they'd gotten a site address or a legal description, knowing that it was not a sewage treatment plant, would have involved a host of other underwriting considerations, and there's nothing in the record about that. And the reason there's nothing in the record, because it would all be speculative, because they never got beyond square one, which was an adequate description of what the property was and where it was, to even take it a step further.
You started out to talk about the negligence of MSD and Sedgwick, and it seemed that Sedgwick is the empty chair here. They settled and they're gone, but I would want to just examine that a little bit about what you were going to refer to as the negligence that they brought out of this.
Well, and, you know, I don't differentiate the negligence of MMSD and Sedgwick. And I've got kind of a checklist here that I can emphasize. But indisputably in this case, there's never any issue that Sedgwick was MMSD's agent. So any negligence on their part is imputed to MMSD and any negligence of MMSD's own. Well, let's look at MMSD's and Sedgwick's conduct. They're told that by Mr. Turner that this property will not be insured without an address or some kind of legal description. That was communicated orally and in writing. Sedgwick and MMSD never responded to that request for information. There's inferences in the record as to why, which was that Ms. Piller and Mr. Spina, who were the principals at Sedgwick, were leaving, so they probably weren't paying attention. The policy apparently sits at Sedgwick for 6 months after issuance without it being forwarded from Sedgwick to MMSD. Nobody looks at the policy and sees that Lincoln Creek is not insured for 6 months.
So what about this other address that does creep in? That seems like such an odd part of this case that ASLIC just decides to throw in this fifth property.
No good deed goes unpunished. What Mr. Henry testified to at trial, and I believe in his deposition, was he was adamant that Lincoln Creek was not going to be insured. In the Phase 1 study that was provided with the application, he noticed a fifth sewage treatment plant. As it turns out, it was misidentified as such in the Phase 1, but he threw that in as an olive branch, saying, okay, I'm not going to insure Lincoln Creek, but you know what, for the premium, as a freebie, I'll throw in 4832 North 32nd Street. As it turns out, MMSD misrepresented the status of that property. In fact, it was a pump station, not a sewage treatment plant.
Well, when Mr. I guess it was, this is the issue that's laid on Crump, but he sent to Mr. Turner, or I guess it's Joe, what, it's, this is, I'm
Spina?
Confused. It's from Turner. I guess it's going to Joe Spina, yeah. And it says that the pollution underwriter is having difficulty adding the entire Lincoln Creek to this policy. They can only add that portion that the insured owns and operates. Can we use an address for their property on the creek? And the court referred to that last part. Can we use an address? But it doesn't say a specific address. So it seems it's not referring to something else to fill in for that that's already on the plate. It's another address he's wondering if they can use. Is that the way I'm interpreting that correctly?
He's looking for an address.
Yeah.
That he never got.
Yeah, never got that. And then the delay you were talking about is how long?
6 months.
After, and it was not too long that they seemed to be right off once the client, the so-called insured, got the policy, they realized this wasn't covered.
Right, and the record is uncontroverted that institutionally MMSD knew 4830 North 32nd Street was not Lincoln Creek. They knew that. My white light is on, so unless the court has more questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meckler.
May it please the court. If I can pick up on the questioning of the panel, I think, you know, one of the issues that has certainly taken an awful lot of time in briefing and devoted an awful lot of time at the trial court, which is the agency of my client, Crump Insurance. While I think the court, frankly, made a mistake with respect to its declaration of Crump as solely the agent of ASLIC, the reality is that issue is not the biggest mistake or certainly the most fatal mistake the trial court made. I think the mistake the trial court made was not looking in a very clear way at the conduct of MMSD and Sedgwick, its broker. That's the mistake that it made. Even if you assume that my client, Crump Insurance, was the dual agent in some respects representing the interest of MMSD and Sedgwick in terms of making the offer to ASLIC to purchase the insurance and in some respect coming back from ASLIC with the binder, the premium, et cetera, the court could have, in my view, declared both to be a dual agent. Whether the court did or not, to me, really misses the central point. The central point
is... But, Mr. Meckler, your opponents at least argue that MMSD and Sedgwick's behavior is absolutely irrelevant under the Wisconsin case Tribble against Tower Insurance.
And Your Honor, I don't know how my opponents could actually make that argument. I think the fourth element of Tribble is crystal clear, which is you look to whether the conduct of the agent and whether the mistake of the agent, and in this case that was declared by the court to be Crump, caused the damage, caused the central mistake that was made here.
Yeah.
And I think it's and you also, I think it's very, very clear from the record that two sophisticated parties, MMSD, which had its own risk management group, a governmental agency in Milwaukee, and Sedgwick, itself a very sophisticated insurance broker in the United States, knew from the beginning that an address to this Lincoln Creek property or county parcel or whatever you wanted to call it was required in order for this insurance to be placed on this particular policy. There was never an issue by anybody, but that an address had to be provided for that property.
Now, so I wonder, I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask or whether it was Mr. Rattan, but one of the things I'm interested in about this case is the fact that the Lincoln Creek property itself that later becomes the focus was not yet owned by MMSD and, in fact, wasn't acquired until, if I remember, October or so. Had that address been furnished, I guess it would have been shown as the property of the city, right?
Yes, it certainly is Mr. Rattan's issue, but although if this court were ultimately find that there was not an insurable interest that ASLIC could have insured at the time the policy placed, then that would certainly rule the day as well, because at the end of the day, it's ASLIC's argument, since there was no insurable interest, there's no coverage here.
Right, and your position is derivative at this point. You're the third party. You were brought in by ASLIC, right, as an indemnification.
We were brought in by ASLIC as notification, but I will say one thing, and I think it's important, and Your Honor read a little bit from this email that Crump, this fax that Crump had sent, and it's very important, and it raises the question of the location of the property as well. Background for a second. After the binder is issued, and the court is absolutely correct, and the trial court agreed that the binder itself became moot. Once the policy issued, the binder became moot. The claim wasn't made during the time of the binder. The binder really isn't something that I think the court should spend much time on. But after the binder was issued, but 10 days before the policy was issued, Crump, doing its job as the intermediary broker, and if you want to call them a dual agent, call them a dual agent, but in any event, Crump sends the email, the fax, to Sedgwick, who is the agent for MMSD, specifically saying, and I'll read it, pollution underwriter is having difficulty adding the entire, quote, Lincoln Creek, unquote, to this policy. They can only add the portion that the insured owns and or operates, to your point, Your Honor. Can we use an address for their property on the creek, question mark? Also, as you know, this policy covers environmental liability for the insured sites, not the actual cleanup or project itself. Therefore, again, the insured must own or operate the property in order to schedule it. Now, one of the mistakes the trial court made was, in the trial court's opinion, the trial court made reference to and criticized Crump for not asking this kind of follow-up question with respect to the address before the policy issued. The court misread the record because this exhibit, which was Exhibit 48 in the trial court, was in fact sent by Crump to Sedgwick 10 days before the policy issued. Thereafter, 10 days later, on March 22nd, the policy is issued. Crump sends the policy to the insured through its broker, Sedgwick, and says, if you have any problem with the policy, let us know. 7 days later, on March 29th, having heard no response to its March 12th fax, which it has read to the record, having heard no response to the March 22nd letter transmitting the policy, what did Crump do? Crump resends the same fax that it sent on March 12th, telling Sedgwick again that ASLIC's having a difficulty with this property. We must have the address. And by the way, the property needs to be owned and or operated by MMSD.
So is there any question about the operated part? I mean, the record certainly seems indisputable that they didn't own it.
I don't believe they owned it or operated it. Based on the record, and I was not trial counsel for Crump. I've come in the appeal. Based on my review of the record, it appears, at least before the trial court, that this property was intended to be acquired, may have been contracted to be acquired, but wasn't in fact acquired, I believe, until September or October following the placement of the policy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So for the trial court to ignore the conduct of MMSD, and getting back to Your Honor's question, which started me down this track, I think Tribble was clear that in order to get to the fourth element, which was basically who caused the mistake, whose fault was the mistake, was it the agent's fault or otherwise, the court must, by necessity, look to the standard of care, the conduct of the insured. If the insured is negligent, then the insured is the one that caused the mistake. And I suggest here the record is overwhelmingly clear, and I support comments made by Mr. Rattan about the obvious negligence, I think, by MMSD through its broker, Sedgwick, of course, the empty chair today, that it was their negligence. They knew that an address was required. If I may sort of conclude on the exchange of faxes, the response to the March 12th fax, the March 22nd letter transmitting the policy and the March 29th refax was nothing, was dead silence for 6 months. Sedgwick didn't say a word. The record reflects that Sedgwick didn't even provide those documents to its insurer, to its client, MMSD. And I would suggest...
Well, they caught it pretty quickly then. Then once Sedgwick sent it to them, they looked at it and said, hey, we're not on there. That property's not on there.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. Once on September 8th, once Sedgwick apparently did send this information to its client, MMSD, and the client did catch on immediately, the problem, of course, is this. Once the client caught on, Sedgwick then on September 8th sends a fax to Crump saying, can you amend the policy? And they gave Crump yet another address for the property, which was also incorrect.
Well, they acquired the property at some point.
The following month they acquired the property.
Yeah, well, then I assume they had a description or something of the property in order to get title to it.
Your Honor, I assume that you are 100% correct, but this record does not reflect, at least to my knowledge, that there ever was a correct address either given.
But even when they had that, they didn't. Nobody sent whatever title they got as a copy of the description.
That's exactly right. And the sad part to me, which is why we're here today, is I think the trial court actually got it during the trial. During the trial, after the court denied ASLIC's motion for judgment as a matter of law, the trial court said, and I read, and it's been in the briefs as well, and I quote, this is the trial court, Sedgwick, I think, dropped the ball with a failure to follow through and add this whole situation could have been avoided. An address certainly for the parcel is available, whether it's the cumbersome legal description or a simple tax key number. An address for the parcel is available, close quote.
Which suggests there's a parcel. I mean, you know, that it's not just this whole environmental impact statement or whatever.
It appears that it was a parcel or parcels along the river that was going to be used as a requirement for the lowering of the floodplain.
Mr. Meckler, is it your position that even if there were a specific address that covered, quote, Lincoln Creek, the fact that there was an ownership on the date of the issuance of the policy would preclude MSD from relief in this case?
Well, that is certainly in the bailiwick of Mr. Rattan and ASLIC. As one that does quite a bit of insurance work and read this record, I believe that's the case. I believe that unless the insured has an insurable interest, it is not able to insure its property. And, of course, once it did have an insurable interest, I think the record is replete with facts to suggest that they knew.
Excuse me. Finish.
I'm sorry.
No, you finish. Go ahead.
You are the robot. I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, that doesn't mean I can't be polite. If the record reflected an option to buy, would that have given an insurable interest?
I don't believe it would have been an insurable interest. There may have been some contingency agreed on between ASLIC and ultimately the insured, but I don't believe it's an insurable interest. And, of course, the factor that further complicates this is once the insurable interest was acquired, by that point, it's clear that MMSD knew that they had environmental problems on their property, which, of course, would then trigger the known loss exclusion to the policy, which the court considered and rejected. And I think that would be a real problem as to coverage. And I guess there's one other element that I'd like to go through with the court, which is we support ASLIC 100% on this, and Crump, as the intermediary, believes that we did everything we could possibly do to get this done the right way and fulfilled our duty. I would add that I don't believe, as coming into this case after the trial, that ASLIC should be entitled to have all of the liability here, if there is liability, shifted to Crump. If there was a mistake, if this court ultimately determines that there was a mistake made, if this court ultimately determines that this confusion was not the fault of the insured who knew that this property needed to be insured, then what I suggest to your court is that confusion was compounded, if nothing else, by ASLIC. And I think the court made reference earlier to the fact that ASLIC, on its own, without notifying anybody effectively, added a fifth property, a property which wasn't provided to ASLIC by Crump. It was contained in a survey or a report of information given at the beginning of this process by the insured. If anything, that added to the confusion of the property, and as a result, I don't believe that ASLIC should be able to to get contribution from Crump. It's hard to believe, as a lawyer that does a lot of work for insurance brokers, that Crump caused any problem here. Crump got the information. Crump passed it on. Crump asked the correct questions to Sedgwick and MMSD, and unfortunately, the insured MMSD and Sedgwick never gave the proper answers. That was Crump's role. That was Crump's duty. Crump's duty does not go beyond that of an investigator. And I think Wisconsin law is clear, as is Illinois in Mizzouho, that our obligation was not to be the investigator and to have to go and squeeze their arm to get the address to a property which they owned or intended to own.
So that would be certainly a legal conclusion that the district court came to, that I see that we would be reviewing de novo. I am a little, well, concerned is almost too strong a word, but it's important for us to bear in mind to what extent your argument is asking us to find certain fact findings clearly erroneous, and to what extent your argument is a challenge to the legal structure that the district court used. Seems like some things may fall over onto the factual side.
I think there's clearly a mix here. I do think that the court, in not considering the conduct of MMSD and Sedgwick as a legal issue that this court could rule on, and we've cited in our brief throughout the whole issue of the jury instructions that were given to the advisory jury. While obviously I'm not asking the court to reverse based on bad advisory jury instructions, I think the jury instructions are instructive and show what the district court or the magistrate was thinking. The magistrate was presented by Crump with some very specific proposed jury instructions that specifically questioned and asked the jury to question and look at the conduct of MMSD and Sedgwick, and specifically, were they negligent or not. The magistrate simply refused to consider those, and as this court has, I know, looked at, the jury instructions that are in place asked no questions whatsoever about the conduct of MMSD and Sedgwick, and I think that was an abuse of the magistrate's discretion. I see my time is up. If there's no further questions, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Breyer.
Good morning. Jim Ryer, appearing for MMSD. What's important from MMSD's standpoint is this case was brought as a result of what has now been determined by a court after reviewing all the evidence. The case was tried for 6 days following the advisory jury on the issues related to what I refer to as the elephant in the room that neither defense is addressing: mistake by Crump. It was a fact-finding determination by a district court, seasoned district court magistrate, and 8 members of a jury on an advisory panel.
But it makes a huge difference if Crump is in whole or in part acting on behalf of MMSD as opposed to acting solely for ASLIC, because for whatever reason, when this case began, you didn't name Crump as one of the defendants, and so when the time came around, it was too late to do that, and so that's just not before us. Certainly, it happens that somebody might sue an agent for failure to perform competently under the agency relationship. And so I guess I have trouble looking at this record and seeing that Crump is not, as they argue, at least partly the agent of MMSD.
Well, it has been MMSD's position throughout. When you look at the history of the case, it starts on Exhibit 4 in the December 7, 1998 communication that started this whole process. And that December 7th date is important because that's when Sedgwick contacts Crump to request Crump, to look into whether or not they can get coverage for this particular Lincoln Creek project.
Well, exactly. And they're asking Crump to go find some insurance for them. And as I recall, Crump also contacts Zurich. They contact ASLIC. They contact Zurich. They're out there looking for a company to write insurance. And one of the many, another issue I'll just throw into the mix is that I gather at the trial, lots of people were trying to say, well, if you say the Lincoln Creek project, isn't it like saying the red car? But it actually isn't, because if you were to drive up in front of my house, blue happens to be my color, not red, but you'd know that that was the car. But if I said to you, I'd like insurance on my house in Austin, Texas, you wouldn't know whether it was property right next to a solid waste disposal site. You wouldn't know whether it was property in the midst of the nicest area of town. You would have no idea what you were talking about. And so the fact that, A, MMSD doesn't even own this property until October 19th, 1999, and, B, there's never any description of it, makes it just about inconceivable to me to think that there was a policy issued 6 months earlier that covered it. I'm not familiar with that at all in the insurance industry. You'll go out and buy something somewhere and we'll cover it. Sight unseen, characteristics unseen, everything unseen.
Well, as we point out in our brief, there's a statute on that subject, 63107 for N4. And we identify that where that specific statutory provision in the law said that an insurance policy is not invalid because the insurer doesn't have an insurable interest. It's very specific.
It's not so much that I'm concerned about invalid. I'm concerned that if I said to you, you're the insurance company now, please insure my property, Black Acre, in Austin, Texas, you wouldn't know what premium to set. You wouldn't know anything. I just don't think that it's commercially rational to think that as a completely sight unseen proposition, any insurance company in the planet would write you a policy for that. Now, yes, now we can add on the fact that they don't own the property. Nobody knows how big it is. Nobody knows how much of this phase one through phase six the Lincoln Creek property covers. Nobody knows the environmental characteristics of it. I've just never seen an insurance company write a policy that covered something that vague.
Well, in this particular case, right after that request was made December 7, which specifically says in there to Crump whether or not they need any more information concerning this location. It's a piece of land they identify in that letter, which is December 7. They're acquiring from the county for a dollar related to the floodplain lowering project. This isn't just buying a red car. On February 25...
But there's no legal description of the property in that letter.
No, there's
it's
not.
Just
but
called, and they just send this giant report, this 250-page environmental report.
And what does Crump do with that, I think, is the next step that you have to look at.
And in what capacity is Crump doing it? Is Crump doing it for MMSD, trying to get a good policy for them? Or is Crump doing it for ASLIC, trying to sell insurance to somebody?
Well, remember, the court had been asked earlier about who got the money out of this deal. Well, there was $60,000 paid in premium. That $60,000 broke down, according to Mr. Henry's testimony at trial. $51,000 of it went to ASLIC, AIG. And the balance went to commissions of the $9,000 between the wholesale broker, which is Crump,
sure,
and Sedgwick, the retail broker.
But you're not arguing that Sedgwick was ASLIC's agent as well,
no,
are you?
No.
So why does that make a difference? Brokers get part; they get compensated from commissions. In fact, that argument strikes me as a strong one for treating Sedgwick and Crump the same way.
Well, I think there's a big, huge difference here. Crump issued a binder to MMSD.
Why is the binder important?
Because the binder then gives rise to the $60,000 premium that it was paying for Lincoln Creek coverage.
I don't know about that, because what the binder does is it temporarily covers the property until the insurance policy comes out. But if sometime during the period of the binder there had been a decision that the property was, after all, uninsurable, I assume there might have been a refund, there would have been something else would have happened. The binder temporarily does it, and what Crump does is they forward along what ASLIC, actually with their little addition, and I mean, you might address apparent authority here, but they, in an unauthorized way, they forward along ASLIC's proposal, ASLIC's temporary coverage.
Well, when we look at the timelines and how things progress, and we have to look at, I believe, from the reasonable expectation of the insured in getting this coverage, which is MMSD, the contact from Crump to MMSD on February 25, 99 is specifically Crump telling Sedgwick, AIG has bound coverage. It includes the location of Lincoln Creek. That is Crump telling Sedgwick, who is the agent for MMSDs. MMSD has a right to rely upon that representation that Crump, on behalf of AIG, is saying AIG is binding, and it's binding this location of Lincoln Creek.
But they relied on it for 2 weeks, and then the policy comes along, and it's not there. So why is this two-week period anything that's of concern at this stage of the game? The claim for the you don't get the property until October 19th. I don't know what this is. October 19th. B, you don't file the claim until much later.
Well, October 19, 1999 is approximately 1.5 months after the last communication that Sedgwick had with Crump, who never responded to the issue of that coverage.
And that's your problem with Sedgwick, for sure. I mean, that you've settled.
But the point is that Judge Goodstein specifically said Crump dropped the ball in his decision, his written decision, on his findings.
But that's Crump. Because he thought Crump had a legal responsibility. And Crump did have a legal responsibility to further your interest, then why isn't that a synonym for saying Crump was your agent?
No, because Judge Goodstein properly ruled that Crump was the agent of Age.
Judge, that's a conclusory answer. I'm asking you, if he thinks Crump has a duty for you, why doesn't that make Crump your agent? Why isn't he wrong? I can put it that way.
Well, because we can have duties, but that doesn't specifically qualify as an agency relationship. You can have a duty, you can assume a duty, but that doesn't mean you're the agent. If you remember, Tim Turner testified on pages 512 and 513 in the trial that he recognized there was a duty to tell the insured if there's a difference between the binder and the policy related to that location. Next question, did you do that? No, I did not.
Well, he didn't personally. He communicated it to Crump, and Crump was responsible for communicating to Sedgwick, which it did, and then Sedgwick doesn't ever say anything to MMSD.
No, Turner is Crump. Turner's the president of Crump. He was in charge of Crump for 10 years.
Well, I think you're playing games with the word you. They don't talk. Crump never talked to MMSD directly, did it?
Crump? No.
Never.
And that's another
reason. It only
reason.
Talked to Sedgwick, which would be enough to get that answer no.
Right. Yes, you're right.
And
Crump
talk
never
to
talked to
never.
MMSD.
Okay.
And so there was never that relationship established.
And so that's why he might have said no.
You're absolutely right. They never talked to MMSD, and there was never any relationship established that way. Yes.
Okay.
Which brings me back to the issue in terms of Crump's activity here and what they did is when you, from the reasonable expectation of the insured, Crump tells Sedgwick, you've got AIG, it's bound coverage, you then get a Crump binder, then you get a billing right away from Aislik for the $60,000 on March 3. You've sought the application.
Was that boiled down by property? Because there were obviously these four properties that nobody's worried about, that you knew you were getting insurance for them.
Well, and remember, that's a very good point, because the four properties, that was brought up a year before, and MMSD expressed no interest in getting coverage for those properties. The impetus, undisputed impetus behind seeking coverage through contacting Sedgwick, who then later contacted the professional with experience, Crump, the impetus was this Lincoln Creek project. Without the Lincoln Creek project, those four properties were not going to be the subject of coverage. That's the testimony.
Why did they even offer coverage? What's the point of, if the only concern is the one that they're going to acquire, why would they, in four cases, I guess, you'd pay for it, and another one's added in gratuitously?
Well, not really, because the prior offer by AIG had been for those four properties. So then the additional property, from a standpoint of negotiation process, MMSC has We'll get all those five properties if you are willing to do it. AIG had, or Aislik had a choice not to do it. Crump had an opportunity to try to get it, which they tried, and it told MMSD AIG will bind all five, the Lincoln Creek location. And what happens after that very critical time that has never been addressed by either of the defendants throughout this whole case, and I tried this case in front of eight people and a judge, 6 days. There has never once been addressed the issue on March 22, 1999, after the premium payment had been submitted, or the premium invoice had been submitted on that March 16th. Crump sends a letter to Pillar of Sedgwick and specifically says, here's the policy.
He includes a copy of the policy with that letter.
And in that correspondence specifically says, please note the changes, limits, deductible. No mention whatsoever of the real elephant in the room is that property. And so then what happens is on September 8th...
But wait a minute. Your opponent, Mr. Meckler, said, though, that Crump had already said to Sedgwick, we need more information, you know, the facts and the resending of the facts, the March 12 facts, and then, you know, the resending on the 29th of the same facts. So does he have to say it every time he sends a letter or just sometimes?
No, he didn't. He never, it's never been said in this record throughout the trial. Never.
No, but Crump said, Mr. Turner says to Spina, we're having trouble adding the whole Lincoln Creek property to the policy.
He says we're having difficulty.
Can we use an address? Well, then having difficulty means, you know, it's not happening. They can only add the portion that the insured owns and or operates. And you have agreed that MMSD neither owned nor operated this parcel at that time, March 12, 1999, or March 16th, or March 22nd, or March 29th.
That's correct.
And so, in other words, you've been told, since you don't own or operate it, they're not adding it yet.
Yes, but the law did not require it at that time.
But they told you they weren't. Whether they, the law permitted them not to add it.
Right.
The law didn't say you have to add it.
But when they, I don't know if the court realizes in this whole record, and this came up during the trial, that address that Aislik threw in, the fifth property, 4830 North 32nd Street, happens to be 50 feet from the Lincoln Creek. Just happens to be, all right, on a phase one study. Now, from the expectation of the insured, you look at that, the request, is there a description of property? When they get the information on September 8th, they tell Sedgwick, just check it out. If there's any problem, let us know, basically, in essence. Sedgwick then contacts Crump again. Two letters, limits, deductibles, endorsements, number two, make sure we get this correct on Lincoln Creek, and they give an address of 5 miles Silver Spring. But the point is that then, on September 8th, there is no further response from Crump, no further, after it has told MMSD through Sedgwick, AAIG was binding it, has sent a Crump binder to it, including Lincoln Creek, and then sends another letter, March 22, here's the policy, no reference whatsoever to those, the property of Lincoln Creek, instead the limits and deductibles, nothing. Then, it's only then, in October of 1999, that they acquire the land.
When did they discover that it was on, not on the policy?
On September 8th, 1999, when MMSD, Glenda Loving, reviewed the policy.
Risk coordinator. Risk coordinator. Yeah,
she's the facilitator. I think that was the word she used during the course of the trial.
So that's an interesting time sequence that Judge Mannion raises, because by the time you acquire the property, you know you don't have insurance for it.
At the time we acquire, that is, MMSD acquires the property, that was in October of 1999.
I know it, and you just told Judge Mannion that it was in September of 1999 that Ms. Loving figures out that it's not in the policy.
No.
And it's then in October that you acquire title.
They had the insurance effective February 25, 1999.
I'm not talking about that. She gets the policy in September 1999. She speaks to Pillar about what does this 4830 North 32nd address mean. She's concerned about whether there's coverage. She sees that the policy doesn't say anything about Lincoln Creek, and then it's a month later that you actually buy it.
That's right. And she, as the insurer, given this history where she had been represented by Crump to Sedgwick, that it was bound, that she acted in accordance with that. There was no response from Crump. She went forward with MMSC to acquire the property. Yes, they had reason to believe, as the jury, advisory jury, and the judge who heard this case heard all the testimony. And keep in mind, they were the ones who viewed the credibility of the witnesses. We are not here doing that.
But the question really, though, is what are Crump's legal duties? Yes, of course, by the time you get down to particular facts, we would be dealing with clear error review. But if Crump is acting in part for MMSD, then it has, its duties run to MMSD. You should have sued them.
Well, if we want to go back into that part of the case, on the timeliness issue, when the facts presented themselves during the discovery, which would allow MMSD to take an action against Crump, that's when it was done and it was ruled untimely. And that was based on Tim Turner's testimony, which he restated at the trial, that yes, he had a duty. Crump had a duty to tell MMSD if there's a difference between the location in the Crump binder and the location in that policy, and he failed to do it. When we learned that, that's when we filed the action, and
no,
it was dismissed on
timeliness. September.
No, we did not. We learned of that testimony from Tim Turner during discovery.
I'm talking about the policy. You knew it wasn't covered.
We did not know that wasn't covered.
Why? Because it's not on the policy, so what, it's just covered by somebody saying so, though it's not in the policy?
If we look at the policy, it says 4830 North 32nd Street.
And you were thought that was the property.
And
when you
that,
knew it wasn't.
But Lincoln Creek had been the policy on the policy that was on the Crump binder.
But then it wasn't in the actual policy. That's the thing that's the problem.
And when that wasn't on the policy, then when MMSD found it, they contacted Sedgwick, and Sedgwick and that's what the jury found that they reasonably believed it.
I'm not aware of any rule in insurance law that says policies must conform to the binder. It's actually quite to the contrary.
But here, that issue was presented to the jury, and the judge made findings that MMSD reasonably relied upon and expected that this was coverage under the policy. That is specifically what was found by the judge after hearing all the evidence and the jury.
It's hard for me to reconcile a finding of reasonable reliance with a lot of cases we have that say that reliance is not reasonable if you don't read the thing that's given to you. Now, here you would have to impute Sedgwick's failure to pass this along to MMSD to MMSD, but it seems to me that's fairly straightforward.
Well, when we get back to the whole law is Tribble. No matter how we cut it, it's Wisconsin law, Tribble, not Mizzou, that Illinois law. The issue is, on Tribble, the elements were met. The judge framed his special verdict accordingly. He framed his findings of fact. Follow Wisconsin law. If it's a unilateral mistake by the agent, Crump, that is the basis for reformation. And that's what he concluded. And that is this is a case in front of the judge. It's reformation, an equitable case. The jury was used by the judge as advisory. And by the way, the defendants are the ones who asked for a jury. They got it and didn't like the result. And then the judge decides, independent of anything except the record, jury's findings, and arguments of counsel, in his decision making, specifically says that the result of failed coverage was a mistake of Crump. And that under Tribble, that's all that's necessary. That's what they made it clear since 1969, upon which insureds can rely, their counsel can rely, and it was restated three cases after that. that we cited in our brief.
I still have a problem with Sedgwick because they're off the hook here. They settled out somehow or other, but it seems an awful lot focuses back on what they did not do. And that's, frankly, that's a concern of mine here, that this is their, I don't know what, why they got paid $77,000, or they paid $77,000. Somebody, they did something wrong, I guess. But it looked to me like they did a lot wrong in this situation, and it just keeps focusing back, at least from my point of view. I admit I don't know as thoroughly as you did. You tried the case for 6 days, but this does seem to be kind of a gap.
And all of this was raised as an issue during the course of the trial. The point is, the jury of eight people said this was a mistake by Crump. The judge found this was a mistake.
That was an advisory jury, and it came up with a rather comprehensive set of interrogatories. That was what the jury came up with. I don't know how those interrogatories were complete and everything, but it was an advisory jury, right?
Yes, it was a special verdict. It was an advisory jury that the judge used on genuine issues of material fact that he wanted to be helped on, assisted on.
Okay.
And that was actually in response to the defendant's request. But what he did use that and then independently made the findings that MMSD and Sedgwick acted reasonably. They reasonably expected that this to be covered. They reasonably relied upon Crump, who made a mistake. The causes, and finally, the jury question on question number 9 was that their reliance on Crump was Crump's failure to get this coverage because Crump did not act with ordinary care. Crump did not.
Is holding the policy for 5 or 6 months ordinary care?
But
I mean, this is Sedgwick. He's communicating with them. We've already cleared that up here. It's not going directly to the client. He's communicating with the client's agent, insurance agent. And they seem to not be communicating with their client.
Well, remember, they settled out with Sedgwick. That can be for a variety of reasons. But the real issue here and that we have to keep our focus on is it was the mistake by Crump between the six-month period had nothing to do with the mistake by Crump in causing the failed insurance coverage that the judge found as a matter of fact, the jury had found as a matter of fact, and told the judge. And so when the judge made those specific findings, it was supported by the record. It was only after.
Ms. Reiner, let me ask you this one question. On September 8th, when Sedgwick sends his fax to Crump.
Yes.
And he says, in looking this policy over again, the address for location 5 should read Lincoln Creek from Silver Spring to River Mile Roads. Please have this amended. What is he asking for there? What is he saying there was a mistake? I mean, what's your read on that? What is that?
Well, the reading, according to the testimony, I believe the testimony from Barbara Piller, who's Sedgwick, and Glenda Loving, who is MMSD, and I was not a witness, even though I was thrown under the bus by defense counsel during the closing argument, along with Barbara Piller and Glenda Loving. The read is that there's been a question here raised by Glenda Loving. She wrote in her saying, Lincoln Creek, question mark. So, logically, she asked Barbara Piller to find out, is there any question about it? So the read was when Barbara Piller sent it out, it was two things that were sent out, two letters. One, limits and endorsements have not been made. Please advise. Number two, on the Lincoln Creek, amend to make sure we have Lincoln Creek. And she incorporated that description in part from evidence in the Phase 1 study report by CDM, which is the environmental company. So that's where it was, to simply make sure that we're talking about Lincoln Creek and not some other 4830 North 32nd Street, which, you know, if, in the bottom line here is, if Aislik had just said no and not given this freebie, we do the math, what would MMSD see four properties instead of the five? That would clearly ring the bell, and instead what Aislik did by adding that fifth property caused major confusion from the standpoint of how that's being interpreted. And they got the six. In other words, the final question is, what did MMSD get for their $60,000 premium that they paid?
If MSD is concerned, as I guess reflected by Sedgwick's facts, that the coverage isn't clear. And they get no response. Crump does not respond to that fax.
That's right, because if... I'm sorry, go ahead.
What responsibility, if any, does MSD have to follow up again when the requested amendment does not come about?
Well, they have a right to rely on the fact it did not disagree with that. They had proposed this language. Crump did not disagree. It was their responsibility, as Judge Goodstein specifically said, they dropped the ball on September 8, 1999. They had a duty to come back. They're the ones who got the binder. They are the ones who were supposed to do it. They did not.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't know how much of my 5 minutes I have left, but I will be brief because I just want to make a few points, particularly with regard to Mr. Ryer's argument about the March 22, 1999 letter from Crump to Sedgwick transmitting the policy, and Mr. Ryer indicating, well, he didn't specifically say in that letter that Lincoln Creek isn't on the policy. And he raises two legal issues, again, which the trial court committed error on. First is, as I think Judge Wood pointed out, the policy supersedes the binder as a matter of law. That's number one. But it also interfaces with the legal doctrine about the duty of an insured to read the policy. And we've cited a couple of cases in our briefs that says if something is buried in the policy and hard to find, we sometimes forgive the policyholder for not reading the policy. But something as basic as who is the named insured, which was the Gonstead case, or in this case, where right on the declarations page, it lists the properties openly and obviously, and Lincoln Creek isn't on there. And 4832 North 32nd Street is on there, a property that MMSD knows is not Lincoln Creek. Then the alleged failure of Crump to specifically say in their letter of transmittal that Lincoln Creek isn't on there is neither here nor there. It's just an absolute red herring. The other point Mr. Ryer made in his brief, he made an oral argument, is that Tribble doesn't talk about policyholder negligence. And the, legally unfounded next step from there is that that they can be as negligent as they want to be and they pay no consequences. Well, there's several cases after Tribble, and particularly the Gonstead case. It's, oh, no, no, when the policyholder is negligent, they don't get reformation. So the fact that it wasn't brought up in Tribble is not necessarily relevant. Mr. Ryer brings up the River Road, from Silver Spring to River Road, September 8 letter. That's just more evidence of policyholder negligence. That description wasn't any better than anything else they'd given. The record's uncontroverted that that description was the entire floodplain lowering project. It had nothing to do with Lincoln Creek. In terms of the property being operated by MMSD, they couldn't operate it or control it because the county who owned it wouldn't let them on it until they bought it. So there's been no evidence that it was operated or controlled. I'll close in pointing out something that Judge Wood said. He said, I never saw an insurance company issue a policy and then something to the effect of on these facts. Well, you know what? They didn't. And you know what? They never have. The policy should not have been reformed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCann. Mr. Meckler?
Your Honors, I think I have less than a minute of rebuttal. I just wanted to make actually two quick points. One in response to Judge Mannion's question to MMSD's counsel. The September 8th email from Sedgwick to Crum advising them to amend the policy, that was done at that point where it's clear from the record that MMSD now realizes for the first time, I guess in their mind, MMSD, that they don't have coverage for the property. The property was then acquired by them on the 16th of October. So for MMSD and its agent, Sedgwick, to do nothing and do no follow-up whatsoever at that point and then go ahead and purchase the property, I think, reflects.
The facts reads, as I understand it, looking over the policy, the address for location 5 should read.
Exactly.
Well, what is location 5? What was the understanding of the parties of location 5?
Location 5 should be the Lincoln Park property. What confuses the record a little bit is ASLIC, when they issue their policy in March, their fifth location is this 4830 32nd Street, which is a separate water treatment facility. But the fifth property there, I think it's clear, is intended to be the Lincoln Creek property. The problem, of course, with the September 8th fax is that's the wrong address as well. So with that said, one last point. The trial court itself recognized in its opinion that if there was negligent conduct by the insured, that there would be no reformation. So while I understand the argument about Tribble, I think the trial court itself properly dealt with that issue and said if the insured was negligent, then reformation won't apply. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.